Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Arizona Board of Behavioral Health Examiner's oral proceeding in regards to the upcoming rulemaking. This is being located at 1740 West Adams Street, Suite 3600, Phoenix, Arizona, 85007. And just in all transparency, we're having issues right now with our Zoom. So with that being said, I'm going to go ahead and maybe make an introduction a couple of different times of what today's going to look like. For those of you that thought you were going to come and see a show today, there's not going to be a show. It's going to be super casual. We have our rulemaking process that you're all familiar with. We have been accepting feedback now for the last couple of months online via our emails, some of them directly to myself. And what ends up happening is we put a spreadsheet together. It'll go before the board meeting this Friday. And on that spreadsheet will be all of the proposed rules and then all of the comments. The comments will be pros and against. At the end of the day, it'll be up to the board members to consider what the rules are going to look like moving forward. For those of you that don't know me, I think I forgot to introduce myself, Toby Zavala, and this is Patty DeBratz. The board did contract with Clinical Best Practice to help us alleviate some of the stressors in regards to rulemaking, and she's here today, too, to help with any explanations that you might have. When you come up to speak, you'll push the button on the microphone to make it turn green. You need to make sure that you state your name for the record. If you think that your name is spelled uniquely, please spell it for the record as well, because we need to have that. Also, if you're speaking on behalf of an association, an agency, or just yourself, we need to know that as well. That information is really important, because if you're speaking just on behalf of yourself, it might look a little bit different than if you were speaking on behalf of an association. The board members are really going to take that information into consideration. Also, just want to share, neither myself nor Mr. Bratz are in a position to debate any of the rules that are before us. The majority of the rules that you're seeing here are from a previous rulemaking that we had a couple of years ago. If you've got comments on a particular rule that are positive or negative, or you just don't understand it, or maybe you have suggestions of a different language, or maybe you don't understand why we're making a change to it, please ask. A lot of them are statutorial changes that we're making, but then some of them we think that we're making changes to better the profession and make it easier for our licensees as well as our applicants to understand. So at this point, while we're waiting for Zoom, we're going to go ahead and proceed. We are here from 1 to 5. You do not have to be here from 1 to 5. So you're welcome to stay here till 5, or you can come up, ask questions, state your opinions, and then leave. All of that information is going to be documented, and you're also welcome to stay here till 1 till 5. This is my 8th rulemaking in 15 years. I brought work to do, because I know at some point nobody's going to be asking questions. So I just wanted to share with you what the day is going to look like, okay? So do we have anybody that wants to start?
Can you hear me? Is that good? Okay. So my name is Jade Rice. I am the current chair of the Arizona Interest Network for AAMFT.
Ryan Johnson, current treasurer for the Arizona Interest Network for the AAMFT.
So we have just a couple of things that we'd like to go through to give some recommendations and feedback on. And I just want to preface that everything that we're presenting has also been discussed with AMFT, and they're in full agreement with all of our recommendations. So with the first rule that we want to talk about, use of legal name in practice, R46206, the proposed rule being a licensee shall practice under the licensee's legal name. The board shall issue a license using only the legal name provided by the applicant or licensee. Our recommendation is, instead of enforcing exclusive use of legal names, require licensees to list their license number in all professional contexts to ensure traceability and accountability while allowing for the use of professional names. Some of our rationale for this, although it's well-intended, this policy may unintentionally harm marginalized clinicians. It could require clinicians to use their legal name which may be a deeply harmful experience for them, specifically for trans, gender expansive, and non-binary professionals. Name changes are not simply administrative tasks. They can involve invasive scrutiny, potential denial, or safety risks, particularly in the current political climate. Requiring clinicians to, quote, dead name themselves, either in practice or in marketing materials, may force them to choose between authenticity and career viability. Name changes can also occur for many reasons: marriage, divorce, religious conversion, adoption, and the impact of this rule would disproportionately fall on women and gender diverse professionals. In contrast, other fields allow for the use of professional names while maintaining legal transparency behind the scenes. Behavioral health professionals already undergo background checks and are bound by ethical codes of honesty with clients. Requiring legal names as the only permissible identifier undermines both inclusion and practicality. Finally, we also would like to question the extent of the application of this rule. For example, what does it mean to practice under the legal name? If someone's name is Jonathan, but they go by John, will they need to use Jonathan on business cards, signage, online profiles, et cetera?
If I could have a follow-up question on that, a couple. You had mentioned at the very beginning that this was vetted through AAMFT. Could you clarify, is that the state association or national?
So everything that we're presenting today was discussed on the state level, and then we shared our feedback with AAMFT, and they reviewed all of our feedback and gave us backing as well. So they're in agreement with everything that the state association wants to share.
Okay. And just the comment on that, lots of times I'm not going to have comments, but I want you to understand where the board was coming with when we created that, is that as a regulatory board, one of our missions, our main mission, is to protect the public. And so it's very difficult when somebody has the name of Jade Rice, but goes by, you know, Jade Brown.
Yes.
They vet them through the verification process on the website. Then they file a board complaint and they say this person's operating without a license. And then it takes board staff, you know, an hour or two and sometimes a couple of days to figure out who Jade Brown is because they chose to use a name that wasn't legal. So we have definitely are very sensitive, you know, with that to individuals that might, for example, you know, gender orientation. And what we always say is, you know, we as a board staff will call you what you want us to call you. However, legally, your license is going to be your legal name. And so really the way we see it is it's a protection to the public. Mm-hmm. Additionally, the entire time I've been with the board, which has been 15 years now, the reason we've always told people you have to use your legal name, we just didn't have it in the rules. So we thought it made sense at this time, since we have an opportunity made that change, that we'll just update that. If it doesn't, you know, if the board members don't accept it, board staff will continue to ask people to use their legal name. Again, it's to protect the public.
Our request or suggestion is if they're practicing under a different name than their license name, that they have to list their license number.
Okay. Are there any other rules?
Yes.
So just side note on that one, and this is me speaking individually. My legal name, according to the Social Security Administration, is Ryan Elizabeth T. Johnson. I did that years and years ago to provide gender clarification so that I wasn't mispronounced in life in general. When I had submitted to the board, that was my legal name. That's how my license reads. Ryan Elizabeth T. Johnson. The name that I use is Ryan Johnson, or I'll use Ryan Elizabeth Johnson. And so the example that Jade shared, somebody whose name is Jonathan, does that mean that the board is now going to require me to use Ryan Elizabeth T. on everything that I do, as opposed to Ryan Johnson? Or somebody named Jonathan, will they now be required to have Jonathan on everything when they go casually by John? So that's.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. So speaking on behalf of the Arizona Interest Network of the AAMFT, again, my name is Ryan Johnson. I'm the treasurer for the Interest Network.
This is regarding clinical supervisor educational requirements, R46214B. The proposed rule appears to remove the current exception for AAMFT approved supervisor refresher training to count toward AZ BBHE supervision requirements, instead requiring all supervisors to complete the AZ BBHE approved 12-hour and 6-hour courses. The recommendation is to allow AAMFT approved supervisor refresher courses to remain eligible if they are supplemented by a brief online tutorial specific to Arizona supervision laws and policies. The rationale is eliminating the recognition of the AAMFT refresher will strip away a critical avenue for accessing systemic training and supervision. AAMFT trainings are rooted in systemic principles and represent a nationally accredited specialty that enriches the clinical. Additionally, AAMFT and other national organizations should be trusted to implement their quality assurance measures built into their training programs to ensure supervisors are trained effectively. We urge the board to continue to reflect the breadth of behavioral health professions, LMFTs, LPCs, LCSWs, and psychologists by allowing different paths for developing supervisory competence. Removing recognition of AAMFT's systemically grounded training would signal a devaluation of systemic theory, undermining one of the key distinctions and contributions of the MFT profession.
Clarifying question. So you mentioned the refresher course. The proposed rule grandfathers in those who are already AMFT approved. Are you just speaking to ongoing refreshers for them, or the proposed rule changes the 12-hour would be required for AMFT approved supervisors moving forward? So are you saying that you'd be, or is AMFT AIN saying they'd be okay with requiring the 12-hour, but then keeping up the status by using the AMFT refresher? Or are you saying you want the AMFT training to count for both the 12 and the 6 as it currently does?
My understanding of the compiled information is the latter. Thank you, Patty.
Yeah, it should be with the supplemental Arizona-specific course.
And are we able to get a copy of that when you're done?
Yes.
Thank you.
We have others. Are you ready? Okay. The next section, do you want me to do this one? Okay. Is treatment plan deadline, Rule 46-1102-1. The proposed rule by the fourth session work jointly with each client or the client's legal representative to prepare an integrated, individualized written treatment plan. Recommendation, revise the language to reflect that the treatment plan must be completed by the fifth session. This allows clinicians the flexibility to begin and finish the treatment planning process during the fourth session. Rationale is that there are many situations in which a full four sessions may be needed to fully evaluate, assess, and identify appropriate goals for therapy. For example, this can include therapists working with couples under models which promote individual assessments to complete the relational assessment, and also therapists working with the 0-5 population must interview multiple caregivers to complete a full assessment and treatment plan.
Thank you.
The last thing we wanted to share, and for those that don't know, last year AIN worked with Toby and AZBBHE regarding the proposed ARC changes for MFTs. We provided feedback, which was accepted and incorporated, and we greatly appreciate that. But there were a couple of concerns that have come up through the course of, you know, just ongoing getting feedback from people about the rule changes. So there's a couple of things that I just wanted to speak to so that people just kind of knew the rationale behind some of the pieces that we've heard concerns about. The standalone diversity course, AIN does not support adding a standalone diversity course at this time for MFT master's programs. The current proposal to integrate diversity considerations throughout the curriculum is deemed sufficient by AIN and AMFT. Additionally, of the 8 stakeholders that we surveyed in the school programs throughout the state that support and train MFT grads, of those 8 stakeholders surveyed, 7 indicated that a separate diversity course was unnecessary. And so we believe requiring a full course of diversity may place an undue burden on existing Arizona MFT programs. There is a language issue that we had discussed, psychopharmacology versus psychopathology. AIN had previously recommended reverting the requirement from psychopharmacology to psychopathology. This recommendation was accepted by the AZBBHC based on the rationale that neither social work nor counseling programs require psychopharmacology, and consistency across the disciplines is preferable. And then finally, the language of 2 semesters versus 12 months. Although the use of 2 semesters instead of 12 months may pose challenges in a very limited number of states, AMFT has shared and indicated that this is a minimal issue and that the majority of the states will recognize 2 semesters as an acceptable standard. And that's all our feedback.
Just to reiterate, the proposed rules that were published already included all that.
I'm just stating some of the rationale to address some of the concerns.
That was exactly
everything is
my
met.
Question.
So I make sure I was, yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
And you're welcome, you know, again, you're welcome to stay. And if other questions come up based on other comments, you can always come back up again. Also, I understand that we do have some individuals attending virtually now. I want to apologize for the difficulty getting into the meeting. But just as a brief overview, we're basically not going through the entire rulemaking. What we're doing is we're opening it up for individuals that are participating either in person or virtually to comment on one or many rules that they support or oppose. And if they have any suggestions or any guidance for the board, what it'll look like is we'll be gathering all of this information that we've been collecting over the last couple of months. It will be going before our board this coming Friday at their board meeting for the board members to consider all of the feedback. And again, for those attending virtually, if you want to raise your hand or post in the chat that you have a comment, we will unmute you. And then at that time, I'd be asking you to state your name and the spelling of your name, and then on behalf of, whether it's on behalf of you individually or on an association or your agency. It's very important to remember that the board exists because we regulate the professions. But we have a strong belief that the professions are going, we want to know what the professionals want for their profession. So it's very important for us to hear from the various associations or agencies and have that information stated so that the board members know where that's coming from. So again, if there's anybody in the room or anybody online virtually, please raise your hand or post in the chat that you have a comment. And if you're in the room, if you could go ahead and just push the microphone on, it'll turn green. And we can actually leave that on too when we're done. Thank you.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. I just have my notes on my phone. My name is Kathy. Kathy Gusenkoff, spelled Gusenkov. And I am a licensed marriage and family therapist.
Kathy with a K?
That's correct. So I do have some feedback about the proposed rulemaking with respect to supervised private practices and the requirement of business education that has been proposed. So I strongly agree with the board's goal of protecting the public from harmful behavioral health business practices, requiring behavioral health professionals to be educated in business operations is an important and necessary step in ensuring ethical and legal practices that benefit both the practitioners and their clients. I do believe that this is a protective measure that will benefit the public. I am concerned, however, that the current proposition only targets associates in private practice, which may be interpreted as discriminatory towards this group of practitioners. And if the board believes that business practices in supervised private practice pose a risk to the public, then it stands to reason that similar risks do, in fact, exist in independent practices owned by fully licensed professionals as well. Business practices do not vary greatly between associate and independently licensed clinicians. independent practitioners who are operating without the same level of supervision or oversight as an SPP may encounter similar or even greater challenges when it comes to legal, ethical, and operational business practices. In light of this, if the board truly believes that requiring business education will be an effective means of ensuring better practice standards, it should be extended to all licensees who own and operate a behavioral health business in order to protect the public. It would be more equitable and congruent to require that all behavioral health professionals who manage private practices undergo this training, regardless of their licensure status. I would also encourage the board to consider how business education will ensure that training leads to real improvements in practice management and what accountability measures will be in place to monitor and enforce compliance. I appreciate that you are taking this into consideration, and I do appreciate the board's efforts to improve practice standards and safeguard the public. I truly urge that this rule be adjusted to ensure a more comprehensive and congruent approach to addressing business practices across all behavioral health licensure statuses in order to protect the public.
I appreciate those comments, and as you know, that they will be taken into consideration by the board. Just a little bit of thought, because there's been a few individuals that have reached out questioning very similar to that. And just a few things to consider for our supervised private practice. We've been talking about it for a few years now. We do have a very high level of complaints that come from supervised private practice. The board about 2 years ago started a rulemaking process where we were going to be changing the ratio from every, 1 to 20 hours of direct client contact. It would change to 1 to 10 based on the feedback that we received from a number of individuals that created, it was very costly and it seemed almost prohibitive. So with that, we tried to attempt to come up with something to help safeguard individuals that choose to go into SPP. What we're seeing in SPP is that people are graduating with their master's degree in the next month, opening up their own business and serving clients. And that's kind of where the concern came in, because seeing clients is one thing, but then actually having to run a business at the same time fresh out of college seemed to be a lot. But with that said, that was our thought process in trying to help safeguard people that were not ready to open up their private business as an associate level. But again, we'll take that information. And Mr. Rotz, do you?
Yeah, I would just add to that, just to differentiate, right, between the SPP and an independently licensed clinician going into private practice is once you're independently licensed, you've had at least 2 years of observing practices, right? Whether it's in an agency and you've seen how forms are developed or utilized, you've, gone through billing clients and those kinds of things versus, to Ms. Zavala's point, being directly out of school and this is your first experience practicing. So you're not exposed to any of those elements until you're doing it and having to do it. I think the other thing was, and this was discussed last time around, was putting more requirements on supervisors, right? So while you're under supervision, as you mentioned, there's nothing that says your supervisor has to have owned a private practice, right? And there was, I think, some hesitancy to go there the last time. And so this at least is a way to ensure that the person who is owning the practice has some exposure to those considerations that they haven't necessarily had for a behavioral health practice. And are you representing yourself as a licensee or an organization?
Just myself.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Anybody online? Anybody online that wants to speak?
Yes.
Okay, we'll go ahead.
Me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, so shall I say it all over again?
If you could, please.
I'm good. Okay. I must not have been pushing hard enough. Anyway, R461101 five. Or excuse me. Two I. It says beginning January 1st, 2027, notification of the extent, if any, to which clinical services are provided through recorded or documented with or involve the use of artificial intelligence, machine learning, deep learning, or any other human simulation modality. Does this include using AI to gather information to create a note? A progress note?
Yeah, it would apply to anything that's used in the course of treatment and documentation.
Okay. And the other question I have is it says a description of the professional nature of the therapeutic relationship. I don't know what you mean by that. I mean, if I'm an addiction counselor, obviously the relationship is I'm treating addiction. What am I supposed to do, or how am I supposed to document that?
So here are some thoughts on this, and I know that Mr. Rotz has some additional information to share as well, and maybe you of the public can help us with this. So our board is experiencing a lot of complaints, and the complaints that require disciplinary action are about 35%, and out of that 35%, 80% are boundary-related. So the thought behind this was if we could bring information into an informed consent to make the client aware that certain types of relationships outside of the therapeutic session or certain types of, you know, communication outside of the session would be inappropriate. With that said, I do think that we're going to get a lot of questions about that. So I guess my questions to you all is how can we do it? How can we inform the client that having a sexual relationship is inappropriate? How do we inform the client that having lunch with your therapist is inappropriate, or, you know, loaning money from your therapist or vice versa? That was kind of the intent, is making the clients more aware, giving back to them, giving them tools to know that this behavior is not acceptable. Just kind of a fun fact I like to throw in: when we have egregious conduct that happens with a licensee and a client, it's typically not the client that files the complaint. It's the next therapist, because the client didn't know any better. And so that was the thought behind it. And I don't know if you wanted to share any more.
Yeah, I would add to that from a regulatory and protecting the public standpoint as well. You know, given the nature of those complaints and violations that have come over the years, also thinking about the importance of therapists reflecting on what that means, right? And so I think that's where it's finding that balance of how prescriptive do we go and rule. It's important, I think, for clinicians to have to sit back and think, how would I describe this professional relationship and those boundaries and what that looks like, instead of just putting a blurb that the board tells you to put in your informed consent. But really having clinicians reflect on that, because when they come before the board and they violated, right, being able to reflect back on how does this align with what you notified your clients of, and being able to have, you know, some of those conversations, I think, is important for clinicians to reflect on, in addition to notifying the clients. That helps clarify.
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Can I ask you to please spell your last name one more time?
D as in Delta. A U G H E N B as in Bravo, A U G H. First name, Robert.
I threw an L in there somewhere. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Looks like we have a couple of people online. So at this time, we will go to Keith Cross. Again, state your name, spelling, and if you're speaking on behalf of yourself, an agency, or an association.
Thank you. Yeah, this is Keith Cross, CROSS, and I'm speaking on behalf of myself, not for an agency. Related to that last comment issue that was just mentioned, I did want to mention I had proposed that in a previous state I had been licensed in, there was a requirement, and it was explicit, just a quote that in the informed consent that it did require, including a statement that sexual intimacy with the client is never appropriate, which I do think would be a good thing for us to spell out in our informed consent forms in the future. But I did want to mention my agreement with what the Arizona Interest Network is sharing around the curriculum adjustments. It's no secret that I would much rather have us be aligned with COAMP standards, which is more or less the way the way that they were proposed. And it became clear that essentially we needed to minimize, since we had no option to eliminate any potential curriculum deficiencies for people who move out of state, where that state requires COAMP standards to be met. Really, it's just a matter of minimizing those. And in discussing, the proposed curriculum changes with several folks, it feels like that diversity course would be the easiest for someone moving to a new state and finding that they're deficient in some capacity with the curriculum requirements, that diversity course would probably be the easiest one for someone to pick up in order to establish compliance. The other thing that we were discussing was the 2 semester versus 12 months. And one of the questions specifically was, if, let's say, somebody starts their internship, let's just say January 20th, the beginning of the spring semester, and then they finished somewhere like December 7th or 10th of that same year, would that be considered acceptable if the standard in Arizona was for 12 months? If you count the actual days and weeks, sure, it's pretty darn close, but it's not 365 days. So that was just a question we had, if the board would take a hard line on 12 months flat, or if it was within a 12-month period, I guess, if that would be acceptable. It sounds like the ASU program is more or less 12 months, but not a full to the day 12 months. I hope that makes sense, what I'm trying to share.
Yeah, to clarify, Keith, this is Patty. The way it is in the proposed rule is occurs over a minimum of 2 semesters of clinical experience. And I thought AIN was supporting that language. So is that what you're speaking to support, or you want to reconsider the 12 months, and would that be interpreted to include that?
My fear and the conversation that that sort of evolved since the original COAMP standards were essentially proposed is that, again, we have to minimize the amount of deficiencies folks are going to have walking into another state that more or less requires COAMP standards. If we say 2 semesters and somebody walks into another state and they say 12 months, they're going to be found deficient, and my experience as a former program director chair is that we don't allow non-degree seeking students to come in and complete a practicum or internship, period. We just don't. And I don't know that any other programs actually do. I don't know of any programs that do. So again, a diversity course, easy to walk in the door, say, can I take this course? Thank you. You get your credit, then you get your license. But a prac and internship deficiency is a whole significantly different process. So my fear is that somebody walks out the door in Arizona, goes to get licensed in another state that requires 12 months, the ability to get those hours somehow in a practicum or internship setting within a university program is going to be very difficult. So if we maintained the 12 months, the 12-month wording, that for the most part, the ASU program does meet that, the question became, and I know you can't answer this, but the question became, can the credentialing committee accept if the rule says 12 months and somebody, and it's like 11 months and plus 1 week or so, right? It does occur throughout a 12-month period, but it's not literally 52 full weeks or 365 full days. I hope that's making sense.
Keith, this is Toby here. I think I'm hearing what you're saying, and I think that is, again, just going to be comments that we're going to collect and put before the board. To answer your question, would the board? We have to regulate what the rules state. I think though that this is something that the board members are going to need to discuss and determine what they want this to look like.
Understood. All right. That's all I had. Thank you all.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I believe we have somebody online with the last name of Kaun, K-A-U-N. Is that correct? Or I'm sorry, K-H-A-H-N. Are you able to? Okay, is there anybody else in person or online that wants to comment in regards to one of the rules?
Hi, I'm Trish Hernandez. I'm representing the Arizona Association of Addiction Professionals.
I'm Rob Dombaugh. I'm also representing the Arizona Association of Professionals.
Yeah, absolutely. S as in Sam, C as in cat, A-L, Z as in zebra, O.
You're welcome.
So this was previously submitted by Yvonne Fortney in writing. It's about... Oh, no, I don't have the exact number. It's in our curriculum item number 4. It's social and cultural diversity currently, and we'd like to strike the word diversity and just leave it as social and cultural. And I see the nods. I'm going to take that as a yes, we have that. Okay.
We did receive that, yeah.
All right, it's perfect. The second item we have revolves the clinical supervision requirements of having the person providing the training being vetted. So we don't see any problem with being vetted. I think it's a fabulous idea. I think the rest of us do as well. However, we're worried about it precluding supervision that we may receive from a NADAC opportunity. I know American Association of Marriage and Family Therapists have their own certification, which social workers do. So that was one area of concern that we looked at, but we don't have a specific statement other than to say that we have some concerns about that, not permitting folks to pursue those sorts of supervision and certifications and be approved.
So I appreciate those comments, and I appreciate the support on that rule, because I think we all know that there's a lot of issues in our state with clinical supervision. And I felt it seemed like the only way that we were able to make sure that clinical supervisors are receiving the information that they need is to make sure that the board vetted through not just the individuals providing the training, but the content of those trainings to ensure that it meets what we need them to learn. We have received other feedback in regards to this as well. And my suggestion is going to be to our board to possibly do a carve out for the associations, because I do think that that's a good point. You know, as my assumption is, and my trust is, that the associations in the state want what our board wants, and they're going to make sure that the content that is being delivered for the clinical supervision training is going to meet ours as well. So that is something that we're looking at, possibly doing a carve out for the four associations for our four professions.
The alternatives would be that either who the association is going to have facilitate the training has had their training approved and gone through those steps with the board, or the association gets approval with, you know, a developed curriculum that then is being facilitated. So those would be the other two options for them to still be able to sponsor and put on a supervisor training, but still make sure that it meets those requirements. I don't know if that makes sense.
Okay. Then I have something not on behalf of AAP, just as an idea. So the concern with the informed consent and adding the information about personal relationships and those sorts of things, it might be beneficial to provide some sort of video for consumers on front pages that go through scenarios. Looks like might have already had that idea, but that's because we can have it and we can know to document it, but that doesn't necessarily inform the consumer. And by that time, when they start looking through there to see what the therapist is supposed to do, there's a leverage issue.
Yeah, and just to clarify, when you say videos, you're meaning videos for the public.
Yes, thank you.
And I think doing this as long as I've done it, you know, one of the problems is there's so many individuals out there that are vulnerable, that are seeking services and have no idea that the board exists.
Yes.
And, you know, I think we can do as much as we can to put that out there. I've even gone as far as begging across the street governor's office to have like a behavioral health day or a regulatory day so we can, you know, this is here because we exist for the protection. So I have thought about those things, and I think those are things that we could do and to consider. I'm just not sure that it's going to get to the right individuals. But I would very much be interested, you know, in any feedback of other ideas. You know, I do think you look at an informed consent, it's a lot of information. My hope is that not only do you have what the board requires, you have additional things for your own protection and the client's protection. And my hope is that you, you know, spend the time to briefly go through it with the client so they know what they're signing. Because we all know we don't read everything we sign. I would just be up to, you know, hearing other ideas, because again, if we can state this, you know, in an informed consent, I feel like it might protect some of our clients. And I just don't know how else we can do it.
Oh, for sure. The idea of the regulatory day or.
Help me out with that. You have a lot more power than I do. And I like the word, I like, you know, I say regulatory because, you know, unfortunately as a regulatory board, you know, we're not always in a good light, but we should be made in a good light by sharing with the public that we're here to protect the public. That's why we exist. But, you know, we have a lot of, I think March is social work month. But I think there's a behavioral health month, and I've begged, you know, could we do this, you know, through the TVs or whatever that looks like, because there's just so many people out there that have no idea that there's a board that exists. And that we're here to protect the public. And I think that would be helpful, because then videos and documents that we upload, we even have something on our website now. I think it says behavioral services. It's a little weak, but our intent there was for the public, but not very many people in the public check it. So any feedback and any help, you know me, I'm right alongside with you to help us make that day possible.
We can plan for next year. May's Mental Health Month.
May.
Mm-hmm. We're in it right now.
All right. Well, so May of 2026.
There you go. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. So we have Christy Kahn online that would like to comment.
All right. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
It was quite a lot of work. I apologize. It's Christy Hahn McDonald, H-A-H-N hyphen McDonald, M-C capital D-O-N-A-L-D. And I work for Youth and Family Services with the City of Scottsdale, as well as have had my own private practice. And I was just, it's an overall general comment. Just I think, I don't know if this is how many people felt with regards to this offering, but I think I didn't scour the new updates. And so because of that, I wasn't prepared to ask any questions, which I appreciate. I just thought potentially that this was going to be an offering where we would learn about the changes, which just because it was scheduled from 1 to 5, I thought, wow, we'll really kind of go through all of this, which I know is a very lengthy thing and I don't have that expectation. I'm just curious. I first want to say thank you so much for the website updates that, you guys are just, it looks fantastic. The website has been so improved. So thank you. But I wanted to speak to, and I think this is on behalf of other social workers I've spoken to in the last couple of days. Is there anything that you can, without going word by word, that we should pay attention to in these proposed changes with regards, I know there was going to be a lot of updates related to supervisors' roles, and I am listed as a supervisor. So could you just do a brief overview on items that you think we as social workers or therapists or, you know, any of the professions on the call or in the room could pay attention to that have significantly changed? And I know that's a big question, but I just was curious.
That's okay. And I appreciate that. Yeah, we would probably be here till tomorrow if we went through all of the rule changes. but I appreciate that feedback. And I think I can kind of give you a general overview. You know, first and foremost, more than the majority of our rules are statute driven. And so it going back to a few years ago when we no longer capture indirect hours. So that's all in statute, but now it's going to be in rules where it's only 1600 of direct client contact hours. There's some driven statute in regards to the compacts and some fee waivers. But I think the things that I'd like to bring your attention to that you all should be really looking at, the biggest change, and these are my opinions, but the biggest change is going to be the change to clinical supervision and having to go through a board approved clinical supervision training. Now that's got some leeway. It'll be down the road. But the intent behind that is to ensure that you're getting the correct content. I unfortunately have seen content that have been submitted in clinical supervision to be on the registry from rules that were prior to 2015, and it hurts. So we want to make sure that the content is accurate. And then the other benefit to that is that when we have individuals that are looking for clinical supervision training, right now all I can tell them is to reach out to their association or Google it. Now I can go, oh, go to our board's website, and we're going to have a list of all of the approved ones. So I'd really take a look at that one. If there was one that I thought was going to be contested through this whole rulemaking process, it would be that one. I feel that we've gotten support from all of the associations on it because they know the need for it, but haven't heard a lot back from a lot of individuals finding this concerning. The cost shouldn't be any different. In person or virtual shouldn't be any different. It's really just making sure that you go through content that we've vetted through. So that's one. The other one is some changes to supervised private practice. So if you are supervising somebody in supervised private practice or you're interested in that, you might want to take a peek. Just a slight change, but there's that. We've got some other really exciting rules. Probably one of my favorite is that right now, if you get approved a test, if you have a temporary license, okay, you graduate from school, you have a temporary license, and you get approval to test. You get that temporary license for 1 year, and you get to take the tests up to 3 times in that 1 year. However, right now, the way the rule reads is if you fail that examination the first time, then you no longer have a temporary license. And it's been that way for a long time. Not sure why we came up with that this year, but we did. Because what's the difference, whether you pass the test at 11 months or 1 month? The idea is there's two things here. One, what the board's always going to look at is the continuity of care. What happens to those clients that can no longer be served? And then secondly, which is very, very important to me, and that is how do we support, you know, our new licensees that have just graduated with a $100,000 school loan. Now we're taking their job away from them. So I think that's a really good change. Mr. Bratz, do you have any others that you think that they should specifically be looking at?
No, I would just piggyback on two of those. The supervisor training, in addition to being the, I like how it was presented about trainers being vetted or the training being vetted. In addition, the 12 hours, that initial training would have to be live, not necessarily in person. It could be a live webinar, but it won't be an on-demand training that clinicians or supervisors could just click through. And so that'll be, I think, another substantive change for supervisor training. And then along with the temporary license, I know some counselors, counseling students are encouraged to take their exam while they're in their program, which makes them ineligible currently for a temporary license altogether. And that would be changed as well. So even if they took the exam while in graduate school, they could still apply for a temporary license. I think those are the key ones. And then the informed consent, which people have talked about a little bit, and here are some additional elements to that if these rules move forward. I do want to say, because Christy, I know when you started, and this may just be the way that I heard it, but you asked about the changes that have been made. And I just want to make it really clear, these changes haven't been made yet. So we take all this feedback. It goes to the board on Friday. And then it goes up from there to the governor's office. So everything we're talking about today is still just proposed.
Correct. And that's a really good point. And I just thought of another really exciting change to rules. Thank you to Robert and Trish. But y'all know back in September 13, 2024, the substance abuse counselors had a name change to addiction counselors, as well as their scope was expanded. And that was all in effect in September of 2024. And with that, had a lot of communication, open communication, and the rules also going to propose. So if you are an addiction counselor right now and you renew your license, your renewal required that you get 20 hours of substance abuse training, which was different than all of the other three professions. And after some long conversations making me understand that, I think that made sense back in 2004, but education has come a long way since then. So we have removed that requirement. So addiction counselors' renewals are going to look just like the other three professions' renewals. And we've basically just beefed it up where if you're taking, you know, continuing education, your job is to take continuing education to remain or improve your scope of competency. So I think that that's really important. And I think that's a really, really good change. So again, Christy, I just, we don't have a lot of opposition for anything right now. So my thought is these are really good changes for the professions. There was some significant changes to the, well, maybe not significant, but there were some changes to the content for the addiction counselors curriculum, as well as some significant changes for MFT curriculum. But since you're already licensed, that's not going to be an issue for you. But just things to be aware of. And as Mr. Bratz had mentioned, it will go in front of the board. I'm going to be repetitive for the next 3 or 4 hours all. So this will be go before the board on Friday. They're going to get all comments, including some other written comments we've received. People aren't speaking today, but that'll be in there. Again, not a lot of opposition. The board members will review all of those comments, make a decision based on what the professions are wanting and needing. And they'll, once they make that decision, then it goes to that next process, which is about 3 or 4 months of a government review, regulatory council to review to make sure that, we're not making changes that would make it a burdensome for our licensees or applicants. And hopefully, you know, that is never our intent. It's to protect the public. And in lots of cases, we eliminate a lot of rules when we can to make your guys' lives a little bit easier, but still protecting the public. But once those rules go into effect, we're going to educate you in every way we can, but the best way we're going to educate you is at all licensee email. So if you are one of those 100 people that every time we send out an email, try to unsubscribe, don't, because when we send you those changes to rules, we're not only going to show you a letter of, okay, these rules are now in effect. We're going to take it, you know, a little further, and we're going to say, okay, this is what we mean by what is your relationship and how you put it in the informed consent if that were to pass. What does it mean? What does this mean? So really important to keep up on the rules, make sure you see the changes. And anything that are big changes, they're not in effect until 2027.
Most of those.
Yeah. Most of them. So you've got plenty of time to continue to be educated by the best that we can do it. Lamar, does it look like we've had anybody new join online by chance? Okay. We'll go ahead and take that one online first. Oh, Larry Seidman. Dr. Seidman.
Okay. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, Dr. Seidman, this is Toby.
Hi, Toby. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for hosting this meeting. I greatly appreciate it, and thank you for having a virtual connection as well. I have some kind of comments and questions around the R46214 Clinical Supervisor Educational Requirements. I am a licensed professional counselor and a licensed independent addiction counselor. Just got that latter title last month. Thank you for the renewal.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering about the Clinical Supervisor Educational Requirements, and I wonder if it would help the wording around B, where it says 12-hour live in-person or live synchronous webinar training that addresses all of the following, because as it reads, it looks like it could be partial. And I'm assuming that A through I is what would be required in the 12-hour training. And then I have a question around R46215 fees and charges and the approval for the training. For example, I am currently wrapping up a class at the doctoral level for clinical supervision, and it's a 40-hour, contact class. And I'm the instructor, and it's through, a university. And would the university have to, and I guess theoretically, a person who wants to be a supervisor could sign up to take that class at a university. And it appears that the class would need to be approved by the board to fit that requirement.
So that's a great question. Let me just clarify that I'm hearing you correctly. So if a university has a graduate level course in clinical supervision, you're asking if that university would have to have that vetted through our board. Is that correct?
Yes, that is what it is.
I think that that's a great question, you know, because one of the things, the first thing that comes to my mind, I want to say, no, it doesn't have to, but where it becomes problematic is what about another university from another state or an online? So I think these are things that we really have to think about, and any help, Dr. Seibin, that you can do for us would be appreciated. Again, the intent is, you know, we have a lot of individuals out there. I don't want to use the word random, but they're just individuals that are teaching a clinical supervision course, and it's not being vetted. So our intent was not to make it difficult for universities or associations. Our intent was really just, you know, more at the individual level, individual training level. So I'm wondering if we were to put an Arizona university. So that'll be something that we can put in there to consider, because I think just based on the way you've described it, I think that my answer would be no, they would not have to do that. But if the rule changes the way it's read now, they would have to. So I think that that's something we need to think about.
Yeah, thank you for that. I know me personally, I keep that in mind. I make sure that all of these areas are covered in my class, but other universities, especially out of state universities, mm-hmm. would have a number of these, but not, for example, the requirements for supervised private practice in Arizona.
Right.
The exemptions to a DHS requirements.
Right. And my hope would be, and knowing you, I know you do make these changes, but my hope is that when universities are teaching a course like this, whoever the professor may be, that they are, you know, fully vetting the board's website to make sure that they're not missing any new rules. I mean, we don't do them overnight by any means, but I will tell you, I still see clinical supervision, PowerPoint presentations that are on paper. I'm sure there's a name for that, that people submit when they submit their clinical supervision. And I'm just astonished at the old rules that are in there. And that's what we want to make sure. So, but we've made that note. And I see that Ms. DeBratz has something that she wants to say in regards to that as well.
I think it's an excellent point to bring to the board to consider. I think one of the conversations that's been had a couple of times in previous rulemaking meetings and such, and part of why this, what was driving this rule is there's, I always say, the art and the science to supervision. And a lot of those courses out there cover the art, right? The relationship, you know, conducting supervision meetings, some of those things, not necessarily the regulatory piece. And I think that's what the board was trying to fill that gap to ensure that Arizona clinical supervisors not only have that art piece, but the science piece up to date.
Is that helpful?
Yeah, thank you.
Have any other comments on rules? related to Arizona Department of Health Services. So it's here and it's not going away, but basically there is an exemption that allows individuals to provide psychotherapy and to do other types of services in agencies that are licensed by Department of Health Services. The problem is we were finding that so many people were not understanding the difference. So you would have Ryan working at an agency, DHS license, doing psychotherapy, and then going and working for a private practice and saying, well, I was allowed to do it there, and then they continue to do it there. And at times, even clinical supervisors allowed them to do it there because, like, well, they were doing it over there. So that's a big thing, just making sure that they understand that exemption and that it's carved out. That's really where it all came from. I can go on and on about, you know, we get calls all the time from people wanting to know, they ask me rules and I'm like, well, that's not a board rule. It's a DHS rule. The intent is not to go into their rules because we need to stay in our own lane. But the intent is to make sure the clinical supervisor knows the exemption, what that means, what it looks like, and that our board rules are our board rules and they have nothing to do with their board rules.
And I think to piggyback on that, you know, AZDHS licenses entities, BBHE licensed professionals, right? And so also the understanding supervisors being able to pass down that if you are a licensed associate or independently licensed working for AZDHS, right, licensed facility, you really need to be mindful of both because you're still going to be held to the BBHE standards if you're licensed by that board, mm-hmm. by this board. So I think that was part of it too, is just trying to ensure that everybody out there who's guiding licensed associates and providing supervision have a comprehension of the differentiation. So I think your second point was, how is it like the knowledge and it being enforced? Really, to Toby's point, we got to stay in our lane. So what we can regulate is the supervision piece. We can't regulate BHTs and the practice in the AZDHS licensed facility. I don't know if that made sense.
These are questions that I've asked of Access and DHS as well. But is there a way for BBHE and DHS to have some type of crosswalk, even if it is a linked FAQ about here's from the BBHE perspective if you're a clinical supervisor, here's from the DHS perspective if you're a behavioral health tech, and a crosswalk?
I mean, you know, is it something that could be created? Yes. I'm not exactly sure what that would look like. Working with DHS can be very difficult and not as easy accessible as the board is. I would probably have a really difficult time trying to find that person that would be willing to work.
I'll come with you.
I definitely wouldn't want to create something on behalf of DHS. I mean, I often field calls and I show them where it is in the rules with them, but I don't interpret the rules for them. I would be willing to do whatever it is to help because we're here to educate and to help. And any resources we can provide is what part of our job is. So maybe coming up with some kind of a plan, a project plan of what that might look like. And then if we could get the right people to the table, which would be myself and somebody over there, I think that's something we could do.
I don't know if you remember back in the day, the first BBHE template for clinical supervision notes had the back page that listed BBHE requirements and AZDHS. And it led to a lot of confusion where supervisors thought they needed to cover everything from both lists in every supervision meeting. And so I think at one point there was an attempt to kind of educate and distinguish between the two. And I think it had unintended consequences and more confusion. Mm-hmm. So would love to see if there's a way to do it in a way that's clear.
This is kind of an extension of those initial reflections. We used to have, there was a ratio of supervisor to supervisee in the state. And I believe it was a 1-15 ratio and then could go up to an exception to up to 30, depending on situations. I'm curious about specifically when it comes to licensees who are clinical supervisors providing clinical oversight to associates, paraprofessionals, and techs, if that's something that's come back up again in the conversation.
So talking about VHTs and paraprofessionals, again, that's going to be DHS. And so I have heard that there has been communication in regards to limiting the number of individuals receiving oversight by a BHP. That's my knowledge. As for our board, it has not come back up again. The thought in removing that, and I believe that was in our 2015 rulemaking, the reason why we removed it is because there was no way for us to monitor it. It was, and again, as a regulatory board, if we can't regulate it and monitor, then it's a rule that doesn't necessarily need to be there. My answer is going to be that, you know, it's up to each and every clinical supervisor to determine how many supervisees that they could supervise, because in some cases it might be one and it might be 14. 14 sounds a little scary to me. There was not an exception though, just so you know, there was an exception for the 30. It was up to 15. But again, when I think back at some of you that I'm looking out even out here and knowing what you do in your profession, if you're supervising 15, that's probably a problem and probably unethical because you have 5,000 other hats that you're wearing. So I always put it back, and maybe it's not the best way to put it, but I always put it back on the clinical supervisor to advocate for themselves to make sure that whoever they're providing clinical supervision for, they can provide the appropriate quantity and, more importantly, the quality that's needed.
I think there was in that conversation back in the day too, was just there's such a vast spectrum, right? If I'm a clinical supervisor with no caseload and I'm supervising, you know, 12 level two, right, advanced in their associate, that's very different than if I have my own caseload and I'm supervising 14 brand new associates. And so I think that was part of it, is how do we apply a cutoff that makes sense? And you really couldn't quantify it. I think that was part of the discussion.
And my last question, going to the curriculum and a curriculum approval. I know years ago we switched to the 9 hours every 3 years as opposed to 6 hours every 2 years. But when we look at different programs, they're always still offered either in 12-hour, 6-hour increments. When curriculums are submitted for approval, will they be approved in 6-hour chunks still, or will be... I guess that's, will it be this is a 12-hour approved curriculum, this is a 6-hour approved, this is a 9-hour approved? Do we have an idea of what that will look like?
That's a great question. I don't believe that we had a conversation that it's only going to be 6 hours or 12 hours. It's going to be approved clinical supervision. I mean, I don't know if that's something we need to consider, but you know, we do often receive clinical supervision, not going to testify to the quality of it, that might come in with three here or three here. So I don't think that would be a benefit for the board to limit it to 6 and 12. I think they should, if it's 1 hour, it's 1 hour. If it's two, and whoever's submitting it is going to be telling us this is for 1 hour clinical supervision.
And it's the objectives, right? It's the elements that have to be covered, right? And so if I lay out all of the supervisor trainings that you did, they need to cover all of those elements. In my experience, most of the 6 and 12 cover them. The 12 just covers it more in depth or has additional, right? But the 6 still has to cover the same elements. So I think the board would vet, does this cover all of those elements?
Regardless of the time?
Correct.
Okay.
That's how I know. Good question.
Ms. Fourier, are you on the phone?
Okay, it's always a little bit of a delay to get that unmuted, right?
Understood.
So, Yvonne Fortier, Arizona Association of Addiction Professionals, last name F-O-R-T-I-E-R. And I just wanted to expand a bit on, you know, first I want to I want to thank Rob and Trish for, you know, representing us there today. We've done a lot of work with the board over the last year, and want to and really appreciate everything that that the board has done and the accomplishments that we've made to date to get some of these the statute changed, and now working on the rules and the rules that we have. So I just wanted to go on the record with a couple of other comments that expand on that supervision training for consideration. We all know there are issues, there's a problem, and we really are working really hard. Everybody seems to be working really hard to try to solve this, and or at least solve for some of the issues that we have with the back end of the clinical supervisors working with their supervisees and the problems that we have identified. So One consideration in our discussions in our last meeting were about making this optional to apply for the board approved trainer in the beginning until some of these things are worked out for now, so that it would be similar to the academic programs. They're certainly optional, and then we still have academic programs that we approve through the academic review committees, and really giving those clinical supervisors continue to seek the CE clinical supervision with them, with those programs that are approved, or with the training that applies to their discipline or specialty interventions within their discipline. An example would be that I have for addiction supervisors to have some or all of clinical supervision CE hours through NADAC and NADAC trainers and their extended partners. This gets a little muddy at times, and I'll just explain that in a moment. Another example would be for CE hours to be accepted when they're acquired through a discipline-specific or nationally accepted organization such as Mental Health America, National Board of Certified Counselors, PESI. There's some really great trainings that are in these by some of these organizations. So also, the muddy part that I mentioned is that affiliates and associations such as ours, the Arizona Association of Addiction Professionals, are continuing education providers. Our association is a continuing education provider, not an individual. And so all of our trainings are vetted through NADAC. And so that would give us also an opportunity to provide a training, a clinical supervision training for the supervisors through our association under the umbrella of NADAC. And if those get carved out, we're already paying fees. We already pay a fee to our national organization as an association, an annual fee. Our members already pay fees to belong to the association and receive training. So an additional cost to be approved might prove a little cumbersome. So those are just a few comments that I wanted added to the things that we've already talked about or that Trish already discussed.
Yvonne, this is Toby. So I just want to make sure that I'm understanding this correctly. So first and foremost, I absolutely understand and not that it matters, administratively support the carve out for the associations. I think that makes sense. It's definitely not what I was thinking originally. And when it came up, I was like, oh, shoot, we need to fix this. But I think what you said there at the beginning, and I think that's the part I need to understand better. You had mentioned PESI and some other, you know, possible CEUs. I think that's where I want to be a little bit more clear is those are kind of the ones that we're talking about that are problematic, because we're not talking about continuing education for your scope of competency. We're talking about the CEUs for your clinical supervision. And, you know, I just, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think that we want people taking a 6-hour PESI clinical supervision training to submit to be on our registry because they don't talk about Arizona. They don't talk about, you know, possibly don't talk about, you know, the DHS requirements and these other things that we think are so important. So did I understand you right on that, that you think that those are okay?
I think there are some that are okay in my mind because they are sponsors of the national associations. Sometimes there might be Mental Health America may be a sponsor for one of the national conferences, and when we collect the continuing education units for those from the actual association, sometimes there's going to be a trainer in there that may have given us some very specific information on trauma treatment, clinical supervision with clients that are suffering from trauma or something like that. That may not be the best example, but those are the types of things that I'm saying. I do know that we want to figure out how best to move this forward. But when you give the national associations some leeway, they may even such as the National Board of Certified Counselors, we accept their exam for licensure. So when they provide trainings for the association or through the association, those are currently accepted, but they may not be accepted in the future, given the new parameters.
Yeah, you know, and again, I'll say this again. I think that's where our concern is, because when individuals are getting clinical supervision training, there might be bits and pieces of the content that we want to see, but what we're really needing is for the clinical supervisors to know the laws and the rules in the state of Arizona. And that's very problematic. When a clinical supervisor doesn't sign contemporaneously the clinical supervision session form and says they didn't know they had to, that's concerning to me. You know, we can only educate so much, but if we know there's content in clinical supervision training that specifically addresses Arizona's clinical supervision requirements, then there's no excuses. They have to know it. And then the other piece to that, too, is, you know, we're not suggesting that you can't take other clinical supervision courses, because those also can be included in your renewal, just not to be able to be used towards your clinical supervision education requirements approval. You know, I appreciate the thoughts. And as I've mentioned a couple of times in this process, this to me would have been the most contested rule change that we're making. And we actually get a lot of positive feedback other than the carving out of the associations. And Dr. Seidman brought up earlier in regards to possibly a carve out for the Arizona universities for clinical supervision. But again, you know, the intent is just so that we can ensure that the information that's being delivered meets our rules and laws. And this is something, and I know you've been around so long, yeah. You know exactly what I'm talking about. And I also just want to go on the record and say, you know, the reason for the charge for $300 is not because the board needs the money. I mean, yes, it's more work for the board, but it's not because we need money. It's just that we don't want every individual to submit for this, because that could be a full FTE, you know, taking care of this. So we feel like if we put a nominal fee on there, that would give us an opportunity to vet through that content.
Right. And Yvonne, this is Patty. Just to add to the discussion, I think for licensees and the public and the feedback that we're getting, a lot of what we've talked about, especially today, has been from a supervisor perspective, right? And them getting the training. I think one of the biggest concerns is seeing supervisees and associates that lose hours that don't get licensed because their supervisor didn't know. And so, you know, if I was an associate at this time period or a supervisee, I would love this rule that's really trying to ensure that my supervisor understands how many hours I need and what that process is. So I think that's just a piece.
Yeah, I actually respect this whole process, and I really believe that wholeheartedly. That and you know, we've talked about this for years, you know, raising the bar on the supervisors. So I'm good with that. What I'm concerned about are just a few of the other things that, you know, we've got compacts coming through, and if you're a clinical supervisor here, but you're supervising, how are you supervising, you know, across states? Just, you know, those kinds of things. And I know as they come up, we'll be addressing them. This is always in progress. It's like, we're always like in process of getting to the best thing that we, best way of informing the public and maintaining safety for the public. So these are thoughts. These are some things that have come up. And I just want them on the record. And but we're all after the same goal. we want to have some really good supervisors out there that are really imparting some knowledge and some skills on their supervisees. So I appreciate that, and I appreciate all that the board has done, all the work that you've done to date.
And I appreciate that. And boy, wouldn't life be boring if there weren't changes. If there's anything that you want, and I'm sorry, were you speaking on behalf of the association or individually?
Yes, this was part of our discussion. I just wanted to expand on it and include more of the discussion that we had at our association meeting.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Should I state our full names again?
Yeah.
Okay.
You don't have to spell them, though.
Okay. So I'm Trish Scalzo.
I'm Rob Dawnbaugh.
Great. So when we were talking about the supervision requirements earlier, I started thinking, because Dr. Seidman teaches, I teach. And so I started thinking about the qualifications for the, so when the supervision is approved, the training, is it person? Is it agency? Is it training packet?
The intent is the content, right? And so again, you know, NADAC could submit it, the college could submit it, or the actual facilitator could submit it, but it's the vetting is the content, is my understanding.
Correct.
Okay. And then, is there an expiration that is defined yet? Expiration
for 3 years. So just like the curriculums, it would be approved for 3 years, and then you would update.
Okay.
If you wanted to.
The other one was under R46214B, when it talks about renewal. It says that we, beginning January 1st, 2027, when we renew, it has to be our supervision coursework needs to be within the last 3 years, a 12-hour live supervision or synchronous, which isn't the issue. It's that we won't have 3 years by the time this goes into effect. So I didn't know if that could be considered for extension.
Or 16.
Because we're at 2025, right?
Well, up until then, they would have qualified under. So then it's beginning in 20. So up until that point, if they've complied with the existing rule,
mm-hmm.
that qualifies them, and then it switches over. So from 2027 on, it would have to be within the 3 years if you're establishing as a new supervisor. So if you completed the 12-hour prior to 2027, mm-hmm. you would fall under what exists now. So
right.
that wouldn't have to be the live.
Okay, I see.
Does that make sense?
Yes, that makes
sense. That expires, and then the new one goes into.
Yeah, so correct.
I have a clarification, please. So, for example, I believe mine expires after January 1st of 2027. So, does that mean that I would be responsible for the new law that proposed rule change if it is adopted, or will I still also fall under the old?
Well, the way clinical supervision requirements work is it's 3 years from the last clinical supervision training that you've taken, right? So if yours expires in February of 2027 and you happen to take yours in December of 2026,
that's okay.
It's okay.
All right.
Yeah. So basically, maybe a better way to say it is if you are taking a course after January 2027, it would need to meet the requirements. Yeah, we always get a little caught up with those before and afters, and but you have to do that.
It just applies to me.
Yeah.
That was it. That's all I had. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Since I know we might have had some newcomers on virtually, I'm just going to kind of restate what I've said before, and that is, you know, we are not going through each and every rule. Instead, what we are doing, if you have any specific rules that you would like clarification on or why, ask that question, or you oppose them or you're for them. We would really like your feedback. We're collecting all of this feedback over the last couple of months, putting together on a spreadsheet. It will be presented to our board members on Friday. From there, they'll be making a decision what proposed rules will be moving forward. And then it'll be another few months to go through the Governor's Regulatory Review Council, better known as GRC, and for their approval, and would really appreciate any feedback. If you happen to be virtually on, please raise your hand or put in the chat, and at that time, we will call your name and unmute you. And at this time, we do have a person in the boardroom here that's gonna go next. So again, if you're online and you wanna talk, put something, either raise your hand or put something in the chat. Thank you.
Hi, Jade Rice, licensed marriage and family therapist on behalf of myself. I just had a couple of questions. So with R46802C1C, technology related to behavior health, such as telehealth, electronic communication, and use of artificial intelligence. I'm getting confused with the such as and the use of and. So would the 3-hour course need to require all three of those elements, or just could it include one, or like if it focused on telehealth and electronic communication but didn't talk about AI, would that count? Or does it need to include all three?
Great feedback. I think the intention was to give some flexibility because originally the last rule making process, it was strictly telehealth and with potentially a caveat for opting out if you weren't providing telehealth. And I think the discussion became there's so much technology involved that something is going to apply to you. And so I think an or maybe, but.
And my only thought there is, currently, I'm still very much personally opposed to AI, so I don't personally have any interest in seeking out those trainings, but I would be forced to if the and applied.
Appreciate that.
And then another question with the the supervision courses that would be reviewed and approved by the board. Currently now for CEs, you know, there's different considerations if a training will count for CEs or not. If that's approved by the board and we are like, say someone's at a private practice and not an approved entity or an approved trainer somewhere else, would that still count as CEs for license renewal because it's approved by the board? Does that make sense?
I'm not sure I'm following the question. Say one more time.
So as a private practice owner, you can't just, a CE offered by somebody in a private practice usually doesn't meet the board requirements for CEs.
Correct.
But if they wanted to do a supervisor training and had it approved, then would it count? Or do they still need to be sponsored by another?
That would count. That would count.
Okay. And then last question, the House Bill 2001, ARS 323271A13, is that going to impact or how will that be represented in any of these rules?
That's a great question. Normally, I would say it's not on the agenda, so we can't talk about it. However, The caveat here is we are going to be adding a rule to reflect that. So for those of you that are not familiar with HB 2001, I'm a big fan of it, and we worked really hard with the legislators across the street to get it to where we want it to be. And I wish I had it right up in front of me. I think I might hear in a second. Let me pause. We get until 5 o'clock. So let me pause here for a second, see if I can find it.
I can forward it to you.
For the 32-3271?
Yeah, 32-3271A13 specifically.
What do you want, just the language from it?
Yeah, I would imagine there's individuals that are not familiar.
I can read it out too. I have it.
Why don't you go ahead and read it out, since I can't seem to.
Yeah, so it says, for a period of 90 days, a person who has completed the person's course of study in social work, counseling, marriage and family therapy, or addiction counseling from a regionally accredited institution of higher education, who has graduated, who possesses a valid fingerprint clearance card issued pursuant to Title 41, Chapter 12, Article 3.1, and who is in the process of applying for an associate-level license pursuant to this chapter, if the person's activities are performed under qualified supervision by a person who provided direct supervision during the course of study or internship. The person may apply any direct client contact work experience obtained during the 90-day period while the person's application is pending toward the person's direct client contact work experience licensure requirements.
Okay, so let me just tell you basically a couple of things. One is, this is not in effect yet. I have received a number of calls already since this was signed by the governor. It won't go into effect until 90 days after the legislative season is over, which generally is over sometime in June. So at the earliest, it's going to be at the September 1st and at the latest, September 30th. I really, for whatever it's worth, really like this bill. I think the intent behind it is really good. So basically what this means is, so right now there's an exemption for individuals that are in a practicum or internship within their university, right? So while they're getting their intern and their practicum, they can provide psychotherapy. There's an exemption for that. What's happening, or what's been happening forever, is that when their practicum was over and they graduated, there was a pause to provide psychotherapy because they can't get licensed or even a temporary without having their official transcript. So some people, let's just say they were working for you, Jade, and they were doing their practicum, and we can't give them a temporary till they have their license. So basically they had to take a pause and go do either administrative work or not work until they got their official transcript. And then at that time, we could give them their temporary license. What this exemption allows is that if you continue at your place of practicum with a qualified supervisor, you can continue to practice up to 3 months while pending your application. The benefit of this is twofold. One is the continuity of care for the clients, which is most important. And that second piece is those individuals that have the $100,000 school loans can keep working and they don't have to take a pause. Also in that is they're going to be allowed, if their supervision is qualified, to count those hours. So what that would look like as an example, this is the way I have to sometimes say it to myself, is so I've graduated, I'm in my practicum, my practicum wants me to bring me on. The practicum, you know, basically they take responsibility in making sure, not the board, the practicum makes sure that you have your fingerprint, and they provide you a qualified supervisor and you continue to see clients. Once you get your official transcript, the intent is you're going to apply for your license within that 3 month period, which you're going to get your transcript within 3 months. Maybe you'll get a temporary, maybe you'll get your regular license, but either way, you're going to have a license. The other piece of that is if you got qualified supervision, those hours can be considered for your independent license. Okay. When all this goes into effect, we are going to have a very well written out board position statement on it. And we're going to advertise it the best way we can, because I think there'll be some unintended consequences. It doesn't mean you can leave your practicum and go work for somebody else. That's not what it means. You can stay at your practicum. And so, but going back to your original question is, are we going to be putting in rules? We are. We're actually going to be putting in an R46211B.
I think so, yeah.
R46211B, and basically what it's going to say, we might wordsmith this a little bit, but it's basically going to be in our rules stating under direct supervision, because, you know, once direct supervision is for supervised work experience and your clinical supervision was acquired after completing the degree required for licensure and receiving certification or licensure from a state regulatory entity, or acquired hours under any exemption provided under ARS 32-3271A13, which is that bill.
Okay. And since Governor Hobbs just signed it 48 hours ago, it wasn't in the published proposed rules.
Correct.
We did not know about it.
But we are excited about it. I really think that this covers the intent to cover that space for those individuals. And I've had a lot of group practice owners have specifically said to me, and Dr. Bailey, I hope you're listening to me up there, have specifically said to me, you know, I'm not going to hire interns anymore because of this, you know, twofold, actually. One, because of this, and the second one is because if they fail the first attempt of their exam, they don't have a temporary license anymore. And these rules are also going to, different rule, but is going to reflect that as well. So,
yeah. Thank you. That was it.
But please make sure you let everybody know that it is not in effect now. I have this worry that it's going to happen because people are graduating right now and they're going to think they can stay in their practicum and keep working. All right. Is there anybody else online that has any comments in regards to rules, positive, negative? Suggested changes? Mr. Cross, can you hear me? Because we're not talking right now. We're waiting for individuals to ask questions, comment. Other than that, it's going to be quiet. All right, so it looks like we've got 26 individuals online and we've got about 7 in person here at the board's office. Just want to reiterate that we will be here until 5 o'clock today, but we do not have a presentation. It's really about you, any questions, concerns, thoughts. This is an opportunity for you to share any feedback in regards to the rules, whether it's positive or negative, or just clarification and understanding of why. And again, if you are online, make sure that you either raise your hand or post in the chat so that we can unmute you.
Jade Rice again, I have another question. I'm really good at picking apart words. So R461101-2I, it says the extent to which any clinical services are provided through, recorded, or documented with, or involve the use of artificial intelligence, machine learning, deep learning, or any other human simulation modality. Do we have to specifically list all of those things in our consent, or is like a more broad statement acceptable, or do all of those things need to be listed?
Go ahead.
I mean, I would say notification of the extent. So if you're using all of those things, I would think the extent is that you're highlighting you're using all of those things. If you're using AI to generate notes, I believe as that was brought up, then that would be in there. So it's going to vary based on the extent that you're using it. But I think you've got to outline what that extent is.
Do we have to specifically speak to artificial intelligence, machine learning, deep learning, or any other human simulation modality? Or is like a blanket term of artificial intelligence acceptable of some, like when we're explaining?
Well, I mean, maybe we can come up with a different term, but basically the intent here was to the extent that you're using AI, you need to tell the client.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're using AI to transcribe their progress notes, if you're using their AI to record the session, you know, whatever it is, and if you're not using it at all, then you don't have to put anything. So it's to the extent of any of these that you're using.
Okay.
I think so there was research done, and this is kind of the language that we kept coming across, whereas if you just stated AI, is there a loophole for those therapists that are also IT, you know, peeps?
Mm-hmm.
Very limited population, I'm sure. But, right, do they say, this isn't AI, this is one of these other terms?
Yeah.
So it came from that research. So if anybody has additional language, but in terms of kind of those modalities, I think it's more important the nature of the use than it is the specific modality. We just wanted to capture all those potentials.
So either one person would be listing out, these are all the ways I use these types of technology, or on the flip side, we could say, I do not use anything relating to artificial intelligence in the course of treatment. And that would be sufficient versus listing out the multiple different.
Correct.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
We have Ms. Fortier, who is on virtually, that has a comment.
Thank you, Yvonne Fortier. I'm going to switch to my other license, counseling.
Okay.
And this is on behalf of myself. And I, as I was looking at the curriculum, this may be something that you've already addressed, but I did mention it in one of our meetings that there is the curriculum changes, R46501. C still indicates that it's 8 core content areas, and it just needed to be changed to 9 if that is acceptable. I originally thought that was like way too many courses, that we should stick with 8 courses, but I was in discussion with a couple of people around the curriculum, and they said that couple of these courses, the research and assessment, were satisfied by more than one course anyway. So that went to 9 courses instead of 8.
Thank you. I do recall you telling me that.
Just a technicality. Thank you so much. And once again, I just want to thank the board for helping us make all of those changes that had to be made to the addiction counseling as well, all the way through this rulemaking. There were quite a few changes, at least in language.
I appreciate that. And, you know, just as a reminder, the board is here to regulate. You know, with that said, the state and national associations is what drives the profession. And so any feedback, you know, that can be provided to the board, you know, we're always going to be happy to assist in, you know, legislative changes or rule changes if it's what the profession itself wants. And it was a pleasure working with all of you guys. And I know it's hard for you virtually, but nobody is talking, and that's why you can't hear us. So again, if anybody has any comments, suggestions, or needing clarification, please raise your hand or post it in the chat. Mr. Schaefer, would you like to pose your question?
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to clarify, just because I hopped on, I believe, right after you addressed this, but when it comes to temporary licensees, are they able to keep their temporary license for a full year while they're testing for their licensing exam, and keep it even if they fail 2 times out of the 3 times total?
Great question. So again, these are in the rulemaking process, so they're not passed yet, but when they are passed, that is accurate. So what will happen is the board will issue a temporary license, and we will approve that individual to test within 12 months. the approval and the temporary license will be good for 12 months. If they take their examination and fail it, then they will be able to keep their temporary license. However, they still have to pass the examination within the 12 months. Otherwise, they will no longer have a temporary license nor a regular license. Does that answer your question?
I think so. But yeah, the requirement is still definitely to pass within that year. But I believe previously, if you had your temporary license and then failed the first time, that would automatically take away your temporary license.
That is the way it is now, correct?
Okay. Yeah, thank you for clarifying.
You're welcome.
Jade and Ryan. So I was just wondering for a point of clarification, since we have you both here and you spoke on behalf of AMFT, Arizona Interest Network, if there's, your feedback was supporting the curriculum as in the proposed rule, but I know Mr. Cross spoke to the 12 months versus two semesters, and I just didn't know if you had any follow-up that we could provide to the board.
Yeah, so Jade Rice, current chair of the Arizona Interest Network for AMFT. We did specifically talk with AMFT about the difference between two semesters and 12 months. AMFT, just based on their review of all of the different state requirements, they think that if this is an issue, it would be an issue in a very small number of states. But overall, the two semesters would not be a hindrance in the majority.
Okay. So feedback stands in support of how it
of is. The two semesters, okay. Yes.
Thank you so much.
They're online.
Yeah.
for those of you online, just wanted to update you that we are still live in Boardroom C at 1740 West Adams Street, and we are going to be here until 5 o'clock. Nobody new has entered into the room, and it appears virtually the majority have, well, about half have fallen off. We still have about 18 on. Again, it's going to be quiet. This is a time for you to look at the rules that have been proposed, make any comments, suggestions, ask for clarification on any. Again, earlier today, I spoke specifically to somebody in regards to if there were any significant changes. The majority of them are driven by statute, which means we don't have a lot of choice. The second piece is we've wordsmithed a few things to make it more clarifying. And then we've added a few things here or there in the informed consent. You might want to look at that while you're waiting. Informed consent and the clinical supervision requirements and supervised private practice requirements, as well as the temporary license. Those are probably the biggest changes. So you might want to take a peek at that. And would appreciate, you know, any feedback, comments, or thoughts that you have in regards to those. Thank you. Ms. Plinsky, do you want to ask your question?
Okay, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Oh, great. Hi. Yes, my question was just the universal recognition that was, it looks like it is being added as, and I just wondered if that was related to the counseling compact in R4-6-215.
Great question. So no, that is not added based on the compact. A universal recognition came into play, I believe, in 2021. It was a statutory change that reflected all boards, regulatory boards in the state of Arizona. And basically, it was a another avenue for people to get licensed because, you know, after COVID and people started providing telehealth, Governor Ducey at the time wanted to make it easier for individuals to get licensed in Arizona. So universal recognition basically said that if you were licensed in another state in the same profession at the same level and you showed residency in the state of Arizona, then you could get licensed in Arizona. It still exists, but our new endorsement law that was passed 2 years ago in a sense, kind of superseded it because now our endorsement says 1 year, same level of profession, same profession, and it doesn't matter whether you reside in Arizona or you reside in another state. So we have to include it in rules, though, because statute says we have to. But our endorsement is even better because it's only 1 year and you don't have to be a resident. Is that helpful?
Yes, thank you so much.
Yes, there's very, very few rules in regards to the counseling compact and the social work compact. And the reason for that is that the board is not in a position or allowed, for that matter, to make rules up for the compacts. The actual compacts themselves, the national compacts, are the ones that are going to define and regulate the rules, and then the states have to follow them. And as we move forward to the compacts, the end of this year and probably the end of next year for social work, we'll make sure that those rules of the compact, not of the board, but of the compact are put out for your review. And you can also find them on their website. I think it's counselingcompact.org and socialworkerscompact.org, I believe.
Okay.
And if not, just Google, and it's just some interesting things in there, but great question.
All right. Thank you.
Uh-huh. Are there any other questions, virtually? Again, just either raise your hand or, put something in the chat so we can call on you. I also just want to make a notation, as I've mentioned multiple times, this is going to go in front of the board on Friday. For any of you that want to be in attendance, you are welcome to do so. Remember, you also get up to 6 CEUs, and 3 of those CEUs can be counted towards your ethics. I will share with you that the rulemaking will be conducted at the end of the day. I don't know what the end of the day means. I'm going to say that's after lunch. So if you don't intend on coming to the entire meeting, which I would encourage you to do so just for your own education, you would want to come by 12 o'clock, as I think the rules will be heard after 12. It could be all the way up to 5, though. And just also want to share with you, that's going to be an opportunity for the board members to review all of the feedback. We will go through the feedback, especially when people are in opposition or they have comments about potential changes. And then at the end of that, the board members will vote on that. Also want to let you know, this is not going to be an opportunity for you to provide any information to the board members. You can do public comment. That'll be at the very, very end of the day. And at that time, they will have already approved or modified the rules that we have going forward. So just keep in mind, if you've got something that you want to say that's heard by them, it needs to be done today. If you think of something tonight or tomorrow, you can email me directly, or you can go to our rules website at rulesfeedback@azbbhe.us. You can do that after this meeting today if something comes to mind, anytime tomorrow, anytime on Thursday. But as of Friday, by Thursday at midnight, we will not be taking any more comment. So if something comes up that you thought about that you want to include, please go ahead and submit that for review. And that also includes any clarifying questions. You can continue to ask those anytime you want. I have found that there hasn't been a whole lot of feedback on our rules, but there have been a lot of clarifying questions that people have asked. And so that's okay as well. Yes, Ms. Plinsky, do you have another question?
Yes. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
All right. So I'm looking at the R461101 and the I and J. I'm assuming these are ads when they're underlined, correct?
Correct.
Yeah. So I think the ad there related to artificial intelligence is important. I also have recently had some clients who have like a phantom account that they want to join a counseling session that's via telehealth video, and it will transcribe the whole session for them and summarize. Is there any, would this be inclusive of also, you know, having stipulations about recording content in a counseling session? Like, I have a statement in mind, for example, in my informed consent that both parties have to agree to allow recording of any counseling session, for example.
So this particular rule is specifically for the counselor, at what extent you use it. You know, but I always like to share when we talk about the informed consent, you know, I'm a non-clinician. I always say my view of it is like a contract. So it's the contract to your client, what you're going to provide for them and what's expected of them and vice versa. So anything, you know, above and beyond what the board requires that you think would be beneficial or provides a sense of clarity just like that. You can put that in there. The board doesn't regulate it. So in other words, if you want to say, you know, that the client can't record your sessions without your approval or without your consent, you can put that.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of scams going on right now where clients are being approached to have their sessions recorded, and then these companies will buy those sessions from the clients and utilize them to create, I guess, robots for therapy. We're not putting that in there, but if I was doing a presentation right now, I would say I think that's a really good idea.
Yeah, that's scary to hear that, my goodness. All right, and then what does it mean when it says beginning January 1st, 2027, a description of the professional nature of the therapeutic relationship?
So that's a really great question. The intent behind that, so just to kind of back up a little bit, so our board, you know, we receive a lot of complaints. About 35% complaints that come in require disciplinary action, and 80% of those complaints are boundary related. So our intent here was for the licensee to basically describe in their informed consent the professional, the relationship. In other words, you know, and I'm going to have Mr. Bratz say this a little bit more clinical than I'm saying right now. I feel like I'm stumbling over it. But our intent was, you know, really for the protection of the clients and for the clients to know that there are boundaries and they can't be crossed. And one of the things I always like to share when we talk about this is that when there's boundaries that are crossed, it's not the client that typically reports it. It's the new therapist that reports it, meaning that the clients don't know they can't have a sexual relationship with the client, or, you know, the therapist, they can't go to the movies with the therapist. They can't go on vacation with, they don't know those kinds of things. So our thought here would be that each, you know, individual licensee would describe, you know, in their words, what this would look like. We recognize, though, if it passes, we may need to provide a little bit more guidance. But I'm going to let Mr. Bratz expand on that a little bit better with her clinical words.
Yeah.
Thank you.
The intent would be to describe, you know, the professional nature of the therapeutic relationship, right? And so the importance of boundaries, avoiding conflicts of interest, dual relationships, I encourage social media boundaries, all of those things that I think a lot of therapists discuss with clients, or we should be discussing with clients, but making it really clear in that informed consent that we've highlighted those boundaries and that professional nature, again, to put clients on notice and to better protect them. And then the twofold of it is to have clinicians thinking about it, right? And really reiterating that professional nature of the relationship. So from a regulatory standpoint, you know, those clinicians, the 80% of those disciplinary actions that Toby talks about, right, if those clinicians maybe did more due diligence in reflecting on that and clearly articulating it, perhaps that would have came to mind before they crossed those boundaries. Does that help?
Yeah, it certainly does. And I think a lot of us do have some of that language in there currently, but it is a really good point that everybody has sort of different understandings at times related to this. So just that the board is expecting us to address this is going to be, you know, mandated. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I was putting you in the queue. Do we have a Jody Cecil that would like to say something on the record?
Yes.
Go ahead.
And actually, it was a question.
Okay.
In regards to the telehealth, two sections, R4-6-1106, A2, where it says that clinicians will be competent. Is that competency then relating back to the change that will, when people are renewing their license, will now be required to get additional training in telehealth? And that was in R4-6-802, C1C.
I believe that is a part of it. Okay. That's a part of it to make you competent, right? To have three CEUs in telehealth. But it's also just because you get the CEUs doesn't necessarily means that you're competent to do telehealth either, right?
Absolutely.
So you need to, you know, make that determination on whether or not you're competent and able to provide that behavioral health via telehealth.
Do you have a sense that the board will know, like, how to define that competency outside of the CEUs?
I mean, that's a great question. So typically, I hate to bring this part up, but usually when we find out that somebody's not competent in providing certain types of services is when we get a board complaint. So right. If we were to get a board complaint where a licensee was providing telehealth services, and it, based on the services that they provided, I'm trying to think of an example and it's not coming to me, but based on the services they provided via telehealth, they weren't competent in providing it. Here's something that just came to me. For example, when you're providing telehealth from a clinician standpoint, you need to make sure that your client's appropriate to receive telehealth, correct? Mm-hmm. So if you're choosing to provide telehealth to an individual who should not be receiving services via telehealth and you're allowing that to happen, I would say that that's an incompetent ability to practice telehealth if you can't navigate and decipher what client would benefit from telehealth and what client shouldn't do telehealth. That's just the first thing that came to my mind. And we would find that, again, if we were to get a board complaint and we would find that this was telehealth, we would be asking those types of questions. Mm-hmm. Is that helpful?
Yeah, that's helpful. Thank you.
Absolutely. Any other questions?
Nope, that was the biggest one. Thanks.
Okay. Uh-huh. So I've had some Patty, Mr. Bratz, and I've had an opportunity to kind of process a little bit more of the clinical supervision training piece. And, specifically in regards to potentially carving out for the associations. And so thinking about that, you know, it's clearly something that we want to consider. Clearly, it's going to go before the board members. I still have a little bit of maybe concern that we want to make sure that it's Arizona specific. And that's like my biggest thought here. And so before the board members on Friday, I want to be able to say to them that the associations, when approving clinical supervision training, that they're fully vetted to ensure that they're Arizona specific. Is that going to be something that I'm going to be able to say?
Jade Rice, chair of the Arizona Interest Network for AMFT. I know it was a couple of hours ago now that I gave our feedback on that. Specifically, our request is, one, to continue to allow you know, for MFT, we have an approved supervisor course. It's 30 hours and it includes a lot of different things that supervisors have to go through to get that designation. And I know the other associations have similar courses like that. So we're requesting the exemption remains in place for those to count towards the 12 and 6 hour requirements. If the caveat being they also continue to still do the online course that is currently required for supervisors through the board, like the board tutorials.
That's speaking to the AMFT approved supervisor standing. What about, so AIN sponsors, right, trainings. And so if the carve out was an AIN sponsored clinical supervisor training, would that be vetted to make sure that it's Arizona specific?
Oh, like if we're sponsoring someone else to do a 12 or 6 hour training?
Yeah, so not the certification piece, mm-hmm. which will be another decision the board has to make, but the actual training piece being vetted. So I think it was Addiction Professional Association for Addiction Professionals spoke to that. You know, if they're sponsoring something, you know, could that count instead? And so if there was a carve out for that, would there be a vetting process?
Yeah, and I obviously I can't speak to the other associations, but I know for our network, when we sponsor CEs, we have a review process where we review the trainer's experience and the curriculum that they submit a proposal to us. So we do review some of those things before we decide to approve the CE. So, I mean, that if it passed, I see that just being an easy change for us. That could be something that is added to our current standing approval process.
So just to be clear then, if there was that carve out, then in a sense, we would put it back on the four associations to vet out ensuring that it's Arizona specific and that it has all of the required elements in it. I'm not sure if I had a question. I think I'm just more making a statement. So mm-hmm. So basically, if that were to pass and we would carve out the associations, the onus then would come back to the associations and they'd be required, which we don't regulate them, but they would be required to make sure that they're fully vetting anybody they're considering sponsoring for their clinical supervision, 6 hours or 12 hours, to ensure that everything's met.
Well, and I think that speaks more to like the trust in the relationship of the associations, right? Which we already have because Absolutely. We're all able to approve and host CEs. So I see that as just being another extension of it and the associations needing to be responsible that we are maintaining those requirements and maintaining the trust that's placed on us.
Understood. The addiction professionals, do you guys want to speak on that? I know Yvonne's still on the phone. Trish, Robert. Ms. Fodier? All right, we'll bring.
Yes. Rob, did you want to say something first?
No. I'm going to allow, this is Rob Donbaugh. I will let you take the lead, Yvonne.
I just wanted to say that, I think it would be expected that if we're conducting our training in Arizona for the Arizona Association of Addiction Professionals, primarily, we're not looking for people outside of the association to be taking that training. And if we wanted something like that, we would, just as we do our ethics training and other trainings, they are specific to the work that we do in Arizona. So I think that would be, you know, plus we would risk having it not qualify if it didn't have all of the elements, because we typically send in the trainer anyway. We send in the trainer, who the trainer is, what their bio a brief bio, and then the content of the training. So we're already doing that. I would expect that that doesn't change. And so that still gives another layer for the board to say this didn't meet the qualification. So I don't see where that's an that much of an issue.
So then maybe consideration for the language is a carve out for the associations for trainings that meet the requirement. So then it's also just spelled out in rule, right? And so if somebody took an AIN training, right, or an Arizona Association for Addiction Professionals training, it's approved, but only if those qualify. So then the board could still deny it if there was one that slipped through that didn't have that. Does that make sense?
Yes. And that would be accurate. That's a really good point. Really good point. I didn't really think about that. So you basically have another layer, because if you all did approve something and the content was sent in and it didn't have it in there, we still have the ability to deny it, which I know would be very problematic on your part. It's a really good point. I'm not sure I thought about that.
Yeah, we already have that layer, you know. Anyway, and we have that in a couple of other areas where if you submit something to the board, you have the right to say, well, this isn't everything that we need, and sending it back. So I don't see an issue with it. I would think that would give us also the incentive to make sure that we did include the things that are necessary. I know we're like really, really concentrating on this, but there's also a lot more to the clinical supervision. We really want people to establish to adopt a model and to know how to actually do clinical supervision. Based on that model, problem solving skills, all kinds of things that go into clinical supervision as well. It's not just about, it has to have everything that Arizona's statute, because we're still going to have to take the 3-hour. And then within that 3-hour could be tailored to include some of the things that we don't currently have in there. You know, we've talked about that in the past as well, that maybe there are some things that could be added to that 3-hour training that would be helpful as well. Sort of a 1-2 punch, right?
Yeah, it's a really good point. And speaking specifically about the tutorial, I mean, that'll be something that staff will be tasked with, you know, when the new rules go into place for us to make updates to ensure that that's on there. By chance, is Brandy Reiner from NASW on the line? And if so, would appreciate if you have any feedback on this, as I know it's already been previously discussed with you. All right, hearing none, I appreciate that feedback. That is very helpful in supporting that potential change. Yes, Ms. Hurley, did you have a comment?
Yes, I do. So do you want me to state my name for the record, or?
Yes, please. And spell.
Yeah. Kelly Hurley, last name H-U-R-L-E-Y. So the first thing I noticed is under R46501, and it's under number C. It says that there are 8 core content areas, but you've updated that to not. Okay, got it. See, you're nodding heads. The other thing I'd like to put under consideration is under R46601 in the marriage and family therapy section. It's letter E. And it says in evaluating the curriculum required under subsections B and C, the board shall assess whether a core content area is embedded or contained in more than one course. When I looked at R46501 under the counseling section, there wasn't such a paragraph under there. And I was wondering if you would consider also including that same paragraph under the counseling section. Unless I missed something.
Can you remind me again? I'm in 601, but where in the curriculum does it have that added?
It was letter E, all the way towards the bottom.
Okay. So this is interesting. So this, I'm not sure I'm able to answer your question. I actually wish Keith Cross was still on the phone. So this section has not been added this time around. It was actually added in, I believe, 2015. I wish that I could recall off the top of my head. I can't. I wish I could recall why they put that in there, but that change was made back then, and I'm hoping Mr. Bratz can remember it, or it's going to come to me between now and 5 o'clock.
I think it was based on feedback from the MFT Academic Review Committee, just based on the syllabi and course descriptions that were coming to them, that they were able to look and identify the elements versus standalone courses. And I'm not sure if the Counseling Academic Review Committee or anybody in that world has experienced that or has spoke to that. So it was AMFT specific, or it was MFT specific, and came from the Academic Review Committee. So I don't know about counseling.
Yeah, do you have any, could you provide me maybe some more information there on just to, because the other three professions don't have it either. And so that would be my next question was, well, do we do it for all? I would definitely have to go back. And I do remember it did come from MFT, and I think the syllabi and the curriculum is very helpful.
When I was originally getting licensed, my curriculum included an embedded cultural competency in every single one of its courses, and I only took a 2-unit cultural competency class. And so then I was denied my licensure when I got licensed. And the person in the licensure room when I came before the board, the person before me had gone to the University of Miami, and she also was under the same issue and problem that our courses had cultural competency embedded in all of them. And so then both of us were denied our license. So, and it, I had to jump through some hoops to finally get independent or get my LAC. So.
No, and I appreciate that. I will tell you this, you know, the longer the profession is here, we don't have as many of those types of issues, especially in the counseling, because so many are KCREP approved. Or approved by our board, but I definitely think that that's something that we can consider putting in there for feedback. And since we have the addiction professionals here, maybe we'd appreciate their feedback if that's something that could be beneficial for them as well.
Or any counseling educators that might be on this.
Yeah, or any counseling educators. I know currently the Arizona Counseling Association is not able to be present today, but I am in communication with them and I can ask them. But if there's any counseling educators or any addiction professionals that would like to share any feedback on that, I would appreciate hearing it.
Can you ask what it is once more? Because I feel like I could speak on two different fronts.
Well, let me just so basically for marriage and family in 2015, due to syllabi and coursework, I believe it was AMFT as well as the Marriage and Family Credentialing Committee added this so that you could use one or more classes to fulfill the required elements. It's only in here for MFT, but hold on, I think we have found.
Sorry to interrupt, but just to, in the counseling curriculum, it does state in D in current rule, and so this would remain, in evaluating the curriculum required under subsection C, the board shall assess whether a core content area is embedded or contained in more than one course. The applicant shall provide information the board requires to determine whether a core content area is embedded in multiple courses. The board shall not accept a core content area embedded in more than two courses unless the courses are succession courses. The board shall allow subject matter in a course to qualify in only one core content area. So it seems to me, since it's really specific in counseling, that at some point there was a reason for that. So I just wanted to add that.
And I feel like I should have known that, but I'll restate, the longer the profession moves forward, the less often we see the embedded coursework. I'd be curious, when was your, when was this that you, and when? So what year did you get licensed?
You said 2007. It looks like, LAC in 2007.
Yeah, it looks like that you...
2006, was when I went before the board. Yeah, it's been a while.
Yeah, and I think, things have changed tremendously, not just with the board, but even within the profession. We rarely have coursework that has to go to the Counseling Academic Review Committee because they're either KCREP approved or they're approved by the board. So it does appear that it's in there. It just looks a little bit different. Did you have any feedback on that?
No, I was just going to say you can use two for one, but not more than once. So it's always out of state evaluations that were painful to deliver that sort of news to people who are trying to get licensure.
That's the same painful news we have.
Yes.
Out of state. Yes. Yep. Yeah. Okay. I appreciate that. Do you have any other comments? Ms. Fotillier?
Thank you. Yes, I just sent a little message there that I worked on the 2015 counseling rules, and we weren't in agreement with the MFT specific rule, but I remember that we had some discussion, quite a bit of discussion around the succession type of language that was in there, because there were many courses that were required as prerequisite, and some of those prerequisite courses, we had to really be careful about them because some of the prerequisite courses were non-credit courses. And so we wanted to make sure that it was a course that was in succession to the course, so that, I don't know how exactly to explain it, but that was one of the things that happened. And that's why it got so specific with counseling, because counseling is so wide open to everything from equine therapy to everything else in there, that people get really specific about the type of interventions that they use. So we wanted to make sure that the coursework was at least starting to, we were starting to gel with something that was a single required curriculum.
Thank you for that
context.
Yeah. Just bye.
Bye, guys.
Yeah, I forgot to tell you.
That we're what?
I know, thank you.
It's a long meeting. We need to sustain ourselves.
All right, so I'm back online. Just going to share with you that it is 4:27 and we will be here until 5. If you think of anything that you would like to share, please do so. Just going to remind you all of the feedback that we received over the last couple months, including today through Thursday night at midnight. Any feedback that we receive in writing and even verbally, mostly in writing, though, please. We are going to put on a spreadsheet. The spreadsheet has already began. It's pretty current, other than a few things that have been discussed today. That spreadsheet will be delivered to our board members, and we will go over all of those comments at the meeting. The board members can modify any of the rules or accept the current rules as they are. There will be no opportunities at that time for feedback from the public. So if you're there and you're listening, you will not be able to provide any feedback or comment. The only comment you'll be able to make will be after they've made the vote at the end of the day when you do public comment. So again, if you've got any comments that are positive, negative, anything that you want the members to hear, you need to do it before Thursday evening. And once the board members vote to approve and or modify, it will be put in a nice, pretty package and sent to GRC, which stands for the Governor's Regulatory Review Council, who will then go through those rules, and board staff will go before GRC and answer any questions or concerns that they might have in regards to the rules. And if there aren't any, then the rules will go into effect. My guess at this time is probably going to be around September. I can't imagine it being much earlier than that, and I can't imagine it being much later than that. When that time happens, we will update all of our licensees by an all licensee email, as well as through our newsletter, as well as through Facebook, and as well as through the associations. We will do our best to get all of that information to them. And if we have anything, for example, in our informed consent where it says, you know, describe your therapeutic relationship, when we have things that are of question or we feel that the licensees are going to have questions, we're going to provide some sample information for you to consider. And that's all I have right now. We have somebody else at the podium that wants to make a comment.
Yes, Rob Dawnbaugh. I'm making a personal comment regarding R461101-2I, where it says beginning January 1st, 2027, notification of the extent, if any, to which clinical services are provided through, recorded or documented with, or involve the use of artificial intelligence, machine learning, deep learning, or any other human simulation modality. I'm wondering if that can't be rewritten where it's more clear, because I think some, as I was listening today, I think some of the confusion is around the wording of the of that something like something I would recommend to which clinical services are provided through the use of artificial intelligence, whether recorded, documented, or involved machine learning, deep learning, or any other human simulation modality, would really clarify that up a bit. It says it means the same thing.
Where
can you say again what you how you would?
I would say from the beginning, January 1, 2027, notification of the extent, if any, to which clinical services are provided using artificial intelligence, whether recorded or documented with or involve machine learning, deep learning, or any other human simulation modality. I think that would clear up a whole lot of confusion. It says the same thing, but I think it's in better language. Because when I first read that, I was kind of stumped.
To which clinical services
Are
provided
using artificial intelligence, whether through recorded or documented with or involve machine learning, deep learning, or any other human simulation modality. In other words, if you're using artificial intelligence to do any of those things, recording, documenting, or machine learning, deep learning, or any other human simulation modality, you need an informed consent.
I interpret that to be more confusing, but that might just be how I'm hearing it. So it'd be interesting to see the side by side and see what the board. Because when I hear that, it makes me concerned that people may not think that the documentation piece.
I think the operative verb is whether using AI, whether it recording it or documenting it, i.e. notes, or using machine learning, artificial intelligence, machine learning, or deep learning, or any other human simulation.
I think where I get stuck is to which clinical services are provided using.
Or involving the use of.
Well, but then I think that's where the documentation piece, I think, coming later concerns me. Are people going to say, well, I didn't use it to provide the service. I just used it later to document.
Well, that's documentation.
Right. No, I agree with you. I just,
yeah.
I'm just saying how
because
much
I
my brain
use,
is hearing it.
I use artificial. I use freed AI. And they provided an informed consent.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
To use, and I modified it to fit my needs.
Mm-hmm.
And which satisfies that already. So anyway,
we could do the language side by side and see. Yeah.
I'm wondering, I'm kind of torn between the two, but I'm wondering just based on Ms. Rice's comment earlier about the notification of the extent. I'm wondering if that's the verbiage we need to change. Something like, you know, beginning da da da.
Or
provide
using any form of.
Yeah.
Any form of the following, and then list it.
Notification of any
form of. Yeah. Then you do an A, B, C, D.
Used to provide and or document services provided.
Yes, you could do it that way.
Beginning January 1st, 2027, notification of any form of list used to provide and or document services provided.
Right, because
I think so.
Yeah, one of them, a specific thing is if your documentation involves the use of AI to create your note, that's one separate thing. If you're using AI to record something,
yeah,
that's a separate thing. If you're using AI as a machine learning tool, that's another thing. And deep learning, which I don't even know what that is. I'm gonna have to look that up.
Huh?
You know, it must be really deep. And then, or any other human simulation modality. Those are five different things right there. I think that would clear it up and make it a little bit more unambiguous. How does that sound?
I think I captured it.
Thank you for that.
You're welcome. And I didn't wait till the last minute to bring this. It was just a stroke of insight. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think we have to because of the statute that allows. I don't know, it was in the one that was sent. I think. Oh, and then we could leave out the definition. Really clear there that I'm fine with it. Go back to the original where it came from.
All right, we are back and we have a lot fewer participants at this time. It's 3 minutes before five. As mentioned earlier, we will be here till five. So this is pretty much your last chance if you want to say anything. Reminder, the board members are going to be voting on the proposed rules and review all the comments that were submitted on Friday. Again, if you're wanting to participate, you could come to the board meeting all day. You can get up to six CEUs that can be counted towards your ethics. If you're wanting to specifically come for the rule discussion, that rule discussion will happen sometime after 12 p.m. up till 5 p.m. My guess is about 2 p.m. But in case you wanted to come, I want to make sure that you're here. So please be here by 12. And I will come back on here in just a couple minutes, right at five, to close out the meeting. So this is your last chance if you have any comments. The question was, what time does the board meeting start on Friday? And it starts at 9 a.m. And last month, we had people all the way down the hall around the corner. So you might want to get here right at 9 if you actually want to have a seat.
Extra chairs even.
Yep. Yep. Yeah.
Oh, goodness, they're watching me yawn up there.
Thank you.
Feedback notes. That much.
All right, it's 5 o'clock, and we are ending our open rulemaking process meeting. Thank you, everybody. Again, you have until midnight on Thursday to submit any other feedback that you might have for the board members' consideration on Friday. Thank you, everybody.